morning, good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, wherever you may find yourself around the world.
Hello and welcome to episode 20 of DeveloPod, the podcast from the IATEFL Teacher Development Special Interest Group. My name is James Taylor, and today's episode is the first of a two-part special on mental health and teacher well-being. In this episode, we will be listening to Christian's interview with Phil Longwell, a teacher and teacher trainer who has been doing a lot of really great work on this important subject recently. Later in the episode, we're also going to hear from Tyson Seaburn, our coordinator, with what's going on in TDSIG news. But for now, let's join Christian and Phil.
Hi, Phil. Welcome to the virtual studio.
Hi, Christian.
Hi, thanks for joining us. You're here today to talk a little bit about maintaining mental health and avoiding burnout, particularly, I guess, within the EFL industry. We might take that a little wider. Can you start by just telling us a little about yourself and your background?
Sure. Well, I started off in 2006, 2007 as an English language teacher, first by going to South Korea for a year and then back again. And then I did my CELTA and then on to places like Beijing in China, Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, Vietnam, and also language schools in Cambridge. So I've been teaching for about 12, 13 years now, on and off, I'd say, not in continuous employment.
Mm-hmm. And so now you're based in Norwich.
Yeah, I've kind of settled in Norwich, and I moved here to a flat in Norwich about 18 months ago. Got some work here with the Norfolk County Council, adult learning, so all adult learners, students, mostly refugees or migrant workers. And I've been doing that since, 2017. But I've also been a freelance teacher for a while, so I teach online, and I've also taught face-to-face, you know, privately, mm-hmm. as a freelancer. Mm-hmm. And I do other things on the side, bits of social media stuff.
Great. So how did you come to be in the field of mental health and English language teaching? Because you become quite well known for that.
Yeah, somebody said to me a year ago that I've become TEFL famous on the back of this. Mm-hmm. Not through the work I've done with the Learning Technology SIG or anything else, but through my mental health research. It wasn't something I just randomly stuck a pin in a book and I'll talk about that at a TEFL conference or something like that. It came from personal experience. You know, it comes from actual lived experience. And I just thought, I've struggled with my own mental health on many occasions during the last 12, 13 years. And it's not necessarily English language teaching that's caused it. It's not necessarily my employer that's caused it. It's just, I am one of those people that is more susceptible to succumbing to depression and anxiety. And I think a lot of people are, but I happen to be working in language teaching. But when it came to exploring this in more detail, I was first inspired by Sarah Mercer's plenary at IATEFL in Glasgow in 2017. I subsequently met her and chatted to her in Malta when I went to Malta later that year. And we roughly came out with an idea of how I could do some research. And I published this research on the 1st of December 2017. And within 3 weeks, my survey request with about 14 questions got 500 responses from teachers all around the world. Wow. So I thought there's legs in this. I can make something of this. I'd already had an idea to present in Brighton, which is where you are today.
Exactly.
So to square the circle, I presented in Brighton at IATEFL in April 2018 on this topic. And it was very well attended, a very small room, but packed with people. I recorded it. It's up on YouTube. It's just hit 1,000 views. Not that people watched the whole thing, because I also did a screencast version of it as well. And I've subsequently done interviews about this and several workshops since. So in answer to your question, it came from within, intrinsically motivated to do this.
I think people perhaps have tapped into your honesty, for one, and your true lived experience, as you say. And also there was a need for this. There was a real call. And I don't think it had been all that well catered for in the ELT profession. I saw Sarah Mercer's plenary as well and thought it was fascinating. In fact, I gave a workshop talk to a group of IH, International House teachers, on a boat on the Thames years ago. And although a few people were doing it back then, I'm talking about 10 years ago, there were very few people. So thank you. Thank you for doing all of that. And I know you might say you've fallen into it, but it's very valuable.
I mean, just quickly, I know that the leader and management, SIG, did a PCE on this in 2015. They talked about burnout, and we're going to talk about burnout shortly. So it's not, I wasn't the first one to talk about this topic, but I think I was the first one to explicitly say mental health in the title of a talk at IOTEFL. We often hear about well-being, and well-being is important, and that comes alongside mental health. But I specifically wanted to address mental health conditions and undiagnosed conditions. That was the angle I was taking.
Yes. And to be fair, my talk years ago was about well-being, and I think it takes a certain honesty, and I think the world has progressed and maybe is ready for this, and so it should be by now. So have you ever experienced, if I may ask, a mental health concern at work, or indeed not at work, and how did you respond to this?
Well, yes, is the short answer. Not just one time, many times.
You've already intimated as much, sure.
I have, indeed. When I said about I've been employed on and off, it's because I've had a long period when I've not been working through depression or feeling that the last job I had ended so badly that I don't want to rush into the next job. So I've had lots of gaps in my employment. I always have to, at interviews now, say why I've had these gaps in my employment history. And I'm always testing the system when I say, well, it's because of, you know, this and that. And I think I've always been the kind of person that is vulnerable to anxiety. But it took work experience to realize this. And there's some situations that I've been in, especially abroad, when there hasn't been much support for teachers, and I haven't coped very much with adapting to the foreign culture, as it were, be it China or be it Vietnam. And after a while, I decided that it's probably not good for me to work abroad where I'm not getting that support, or I'm in a situation that I don't feel like I've settled in a place. So I decided to come back to the UK and get work back here. But the problem came with me. It wasn't just about being abroad. It was maybe in a situation where I felt pressure or pressure to perform. And if things weren't in place, and by things being in place, I mean just knowing where my classroom is, knowing who my students are, knowing what I'm teaching with, if there were too many unknowns as I started my job, then that would cause me to feel unsettled and bring the anxiety up. So I remember one particular experience in the summer of 2013 when I just was confronted by this class full of new students on a pre-sessional course, and I froze because I didn't have enough books, I wasn't prepared, this is the first time I'd done it, I'd had hardly any training, and I just had a panic attack right there in front of the students, and I left. So I have had lived experience, and it hasn't always been pleasant, and I've often left work early or not seen out a contract fully. But I've also learned along the way how to deal with my condition and what I'm susceptible with.
Yeah, I can certainly identify with that myself, Phil. I've had panic attacks, including at work, contracts finishing early. In my earlier days of EFL teaching, and later, in fact, I had a panic attack and crisis. One might call it a breakdown, others would call it a breakthrough or something in between. But a very positive experience in many ways, but very frightening at the time. And people don't understand it generally. And I certainly have a takeaway experience, if you like, some learning from that. But it's a process. For me, it's about looking at each situation differently and not reacting the same next time, and a kind of mindfulness, if you like, knowing we have the choice of how to react to a certain situation. And just because it may have happened before, it doesn't mean to say it will happen again, or even if it does, in the same way. What is the takeaway lesson, if you like, if we have to talk about lessons for you?
That's a good question. I mean, I have, with each experience I have, I do learn from it. So although it might happen again in a different situation, I learn from that too. And what I mean by that is I go into situations because I need work, I need to earn money, and I take on work. Sometimes I feel that everything is fine, things are in place, and I go looking for that now. I look for things in place. So if I've got a supportive staff room, or I've got colleagues, or I know where this is and where the staff room is and where the books are and the resources, there has to be enough things in place for me to feel okay, for feel that I can do that job. And I usually know within the first week, often the induction week or the first teaching week. And you know that expression about whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, it's true in my case, because it hasn't killed me yet, and it won't kill me. It's just something that I have to manage. And so my choices in the last few years have been a bit more selective, and I've chosen to live in a place I know, Norwich, work at a place that I'm familiar with, for example, the University of East Anglia for the last 2 years, and deliberately make sure that there are friends and colleagues around me that are going to be supportive, either formally as a line manager would be, or a senior teacher would be, or just as a friend would be. So, and I've learned much more about myself through reading blog posts and reading books and taking on mindfulness myself and putting things in place where I mitigate or I minimize, should I say, this happening again. It's not a case of going, I'm trying to avoid this happening, because it's then the elephant in the staff room. It's the kind of, this big thing that's going to eat me alive if I don't look after it. No, I don't think of it in that sense. I just go, I'm aware that this could happen if things aren't in place. So I make and take positive steps to make sure that things are in place. And if I need something that supports me in the workplace, I'll ask for it.
Great. Thank you for your honesty and also detail there. Fascinating. Let me pick up on something that you mentioned, and that's you've chosen to live in a city that you know and is familiar, and that in the past there have been places you've traveled to, like China and Vietnam, I think you mentioned, where there haven't been those support structures in place. Whilst presumably you would agree with me that we have a responsibility for ourselves and to look after ourselves and resource ourselves, it's about the interconnectedness of the work environment. So what are some of the things that ELT organizations, managers perhaps, and people within organizations can do to promote and support mental health?
Well, for a while now, there's been campaigns, not just within ELT, but in the wider workplace, to get a mental health first aider alongside a physical first aider. We're not there yet, but we are. The UK, for example, is making some progress in that area. And the way it's making progress is by people like myself and other people within our own little industries talking about the issue, reducing the stigma, normalizing mental health conditions that a lot of us go through either on a permanent basis or on a temporary basis.
Yeah, I was due to train up as a mental health first aider myself, and then coronavirus hit.
Oh, really?
Are you trained up yourself?
I've done Mental Health First Aid England training through MIND. So I've done MIND's, the mental health charity in the UK, their mental health training. I did it here in Norwich, actually, a few years ago, just as I was getting back into work again, firstly by volunteering for MIND with a class full of refugees, and then more fully as an employer with Norfolk County Council. And one of my key questions in my research was, would you disclose a mental health condition up front or in an interview? And this is something I've tested for myself in reality, because I wouldn't want to work for an organization or an institution that doesn't support and doesn't understand mental health, mental illness, or mental health conditions. So an employer, or at least a line manager, needs to have some idea of the understanding. Because if I go way back to when I worked for, dare I say, Ofsted 20 years ago, the human resources representative hadn't even heard of depression. So it wasn't a thing that wasn't really discussed that much. It certainly wasn't known by an HR person. But we are getting better, but there are still institutions that don't really fully understand the issues or how to deal with it when it happens.
I agree. We're getting better and it's becoming more integrated, but it's a slow process. Let me give you an example. I was working at a major, I say major because I want people to understand the magnitude of this, but it's a major government organization. And this was only about 3 years ago or less. And it was Mental Health Awareness Week. And there were posters, and that was it. There was no email, no other information, and there were plenty of communication channels. There were posters behind the toilet door, and you couldn't see them because the door would open inwards. Are you going to stand there looking at the toilet door, you know, in danger of being hit in the face by the door? So my point is that although there was a will there, they weren't following through.
Yeah, that's very typical, actually, Christian, of the kind of thing that, say, an institution, a reputable, shall we say, employer, without naming names, would do. They would, what I would call, they would pay lip service to mental health. Mm-hmm. They would put up the posters when it's World Mental Health Day. Mm-hmm. They will maybe put a few coasters around when it's Time to Talk Day in February. And that's about the sum of their contribution to this. And they'll say, oh yes, you can talk to this person if you have a problem. But it's not very, I mean, in some ways I understand that, as long as staff know where to go and that they are then genuinely supported when they get to that person, rather than it just being, oh well, we're ticking a box here. But it is getting better.
Yeah.
There are some lots of good examples of employers really taking this seriously. Oh. And I've chosen, I don't mind saying that I've chosen to work at the University of Sheffield this coming summer, because I know that they have a good support structure around mental health already in place. So yes, we have to welcome any moves by an institution to have a week or a day where they focus on teacher wellbeing. But we also have to remember that they're often trying to tick a box and pay lip service in this area. And real quality support for staff is not just one day a month or when it's an anniversary of Time to Talk or another mental health campaign. This is an ongoing thing. It should be all year round and all of the time. So there always has to be at least somebody in place. Even if it's not a mental health first aider within ELT, there needs to be somebody that has the skills and the training and the understanding and maybe even the lived experience to be able to deal with staff in that situation.
Yeah, I was working, I think I can say, EF probably about 20 years ago now, and there was an informal counsellor who was actually the accountant, but she had training in counselling and people used to go to her semi-informally, and that was a really beautiful thing to have, and I think quite ahead of its time. People have been doing this for years, as you say, and it's getting better and better. It just needs to be more integrated, doesn't it?
Indeed. And when I presented at a workshop in Liverpool, the RTFL conference in Liverpool in 2019, I asked this question about, you know, would you as an employer or a manager want someone, a new employee, to disclose a condition up front? Mm-hmm. And the first person to respond was a manager within ELT. And he said, yes, he would want someone to respond so he could put measures in place to support that person. And that's great. And there are lots of examples of managers doing that, but not all do, or some might shy away from it because you have to understand the condition that is being presented. Mm-hmm. So the thing about that is you have to understand that you have to give people a chance to give you that support. Mm. There may not always be a designated mental health first aider, but there may be a physical first aider who is also trained in mental health, or there is an understanding line manager or senior teacher who has had a lived experience. And that is quite often the case. And they can draw on their own experience to help a member of staff. Because quite often what happens is when you have something like anxiety or panic disorder, your brainwaves, your thought patterns get overwhelmed and you start thinking, you start catastrophizing and thinking the worst situation. Oh, if I don't turn up for class today, I'm going to lose my job. You know, catastrophizing. Mm-hmm. But there is often a way forward in terms of talking something through before it becomes too much of an issue. Yes. Mm. Yeah. And in terms of burnout, which is what we're coming on to, we need to take steps to avoid burnout, and workload is a huge contributor to that.
You're talking about your own employer there, and I can identify with that. My current employer, I chose not to disclose to my current employer when I got the job. And that's for many reasons, and partly because, well, partly fear. But the other thing is, I was pretty sure that they wouldn't be able to support me and that I had the resources to do it myself, or so I thought. So I made a vlog coming clean about the fact I've had a breakdown. Actually, at IATEFL last year, and my employer saw it. And he said, you know what? That's cool. I understand it. We all have histories. And if you ever just need to take a break, walk out, you know, that's fine. Just do what you need. And just that much was enough, just to feel that connection and know that someone understood. Okay. So what are some of the things that we as teachers can do to maintain our mental health, our equilibrium?
Learn to say no.
Okay. I find that difficult. How about you?
Yeah, I'm still learning.
Okay.
I mean, the way I say it, because it links into when you take on too much as a teacher, and teaching can be a stressful job at the best of times. It can be a great job. It can also be very stressful if you're fully employed. Mm-hmm. Within a job, you can take on too much. And sometimes that is things that you don't have to take on necessarily. Either you volunteer to take on extra things like I have done in the past when I'm feeling great, or the nature of the work or the nature of a course that you're teaching on is such that you have to take on more work. So take on work that you know is manageable. Know when the end of the day is. Know when the weekends are, and keep your weekends if you can possibly do that, unless you're marking essays at the end of the course.
Good advice.
Look after your physical health, because the physical health and the mental health are entwined. And talk to people. Don't isolate yourself and keep problems to yourself. Make sure you share with others. Always find someone that you work with, because quite often in an intensive course, you're only surrounded by people who are on the same course, teaching on the same course, because you're in a kind of hermetic bubble or of your own. So always find someone that you can talk to. But yeah, saying no, I think, is my big one, because I'm guilty of it myself. I take on too much, and not all of it is needed in order to do my job.
So saying no, managing your workload, if you like, and making sure there's someone to talk to, opening up there, finding those channels of communication, and anything
and mindfulness.
Else?
Mindfulness too is also, I mean, even when things are going well for me, I try to practice mindfulness as a way to take stock of the day I've had. Mm-hmm. So when I've had a successful time, and I've often have, for example, I had two fantastic summers at the University of East Anglia, and, you know, not a foot wrong. It was brilliant. But I also had to be mindful of going, well, this is going really, really well. So really be grateful for this. Mm-hmm. And I know it's something Sarah Mercer talks about when she talks about teacher well-being, is make sure that you find time to be grateful for things. And that's a conscious act. You don't just say, oh, I'm grateful for it. You make a time when you say, I'm grateful for this today. I'm really happy that this went well today, or that class responded in the way they did, or I was given that classroom, which is the ideal classroom for me. So it's lots of things that you can do. So mindfulness is part of it, being grateful for things, and also not taking on too much, and also just making time for physical activities too.
For ourselves.
Eating well and getting good sleep as well. Yeah. These are all lots of factors which help our well-being and stop us from running dry completely.
Mm. But ELT organisations can be perhaps particularly stressful organisations. Yeah, a staff room could be particularly stressful. I think if you're at that photocopier and you're queuing or it's going wrong, the photocopier, that can be intense. You're trying to get into class, and those little kind of bottlenecks of tension crop up quite often. And it's stressful putting on a face sometimes and being with students. I'd like to pick up on something that you said, and that is being grateful. And I think that's really sound advice. And if we can be grateful in every moment as well, and being conscious, and that's a process, of course, that's for me real mindfulness. However, it's fine not to be in the moment. It's fine not to be grateful. It's fine to be a bit angsty and recognizing where you are. And that's okay, because if we're teaching a full timetable, then we just need to be honest with where we're at. Just embracing what is.
And indeed, and what we both know about mindfulness is it's about being in the present moment, mm-hmm. not thinking about what's just gone, not thinking about what's coming up next week. It's about being in the present moment and noticing how you are feeling at that time. Mm-hmm. And it's not always good. It can be good, but it's not always good. But it will pass. Mm. You know, it's not there permanently. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah. Great, we're on the same page. For me, I know they're just words, but we're language teachers. It's not about good and bad. It's about emotions and a whole gamut of emotions, and they're all acceptable within this wonderful world. And so if we feel a negative emotion, just going, okay, what is that? Or if we feel stress, or if we feel like we're about to explode, or we go into a meltdown, or just be angry about something, whatever it may be. It's just about, well, what is that? That's not neither good or bad. And then it passes. So what can we do to avoid burnout then? Because we don't want to get to that stage where we explode or we melt down or whatever it may be. So what can we do?
Well, I've burnt out in the past because I've been a perfectionist. And over the years, I've had to embrace my imperfections and learn quite deliberately and quite consciously not to be a perfect teacher. And what I find in my research that I did, and anecdotally, is that teachers that burn out do two things. They tend to be perfectionists, and they tend to worry too much and take on extra work because they're always trying to prove something or prove their worth. Maybe because they've got an underlying anxiety that they're maybe not good enough to be in the job that they've been given or something like that. I'm talking about a sort of an underlying concern that they might have.
Or something from their child. Who knows? But it's there, right? Yeah.
It's just there. Yeah. Who knows what it is? It's underlying. So you're not always conscious of it. But it kind of drives the mind to seek to do more, which can then inevitably lead, when you add in factors like student behavior and demands from the course or the language school, and things like the pressure of passing an observation as another example. Mm-hmm. These are all things that can possibly lead to burnout in teachers if they're not careful and if they don't look after themselves and they don't make time for themselves away from work. So you can be fully employed and you still need to think about what you do away from work. Chance to chill out, chance to unwind, getting sleep is very important, all these things.
So we've talked about those things. I think there's a real crossover, isn't there, between the question I asked you before about what the things we can do as teachers to maintain our mental health, and what I've just asked, how can we avoid burnout? But in terms of actually, if you think, okay, I'm hitting a wall here, I'm about to hit a wall. One thing I think we can do is seeing the symptom, what comes up in you, and that's from experience, I think. But what are some of the other things that we can do when we think we're about to hit that wall?
Well, if all your steps to manage how you're feeling, then you might need to talk to somebody within your employment, someone that you know you can approach. If there is a designated person, that's fine. If there's someone that you can trust, that's even better. I mean, I'm not an expert on dealing with burnout in teachers. And the reason I say that is because I now take steps. I decide not to take on too much now because I know what is manageable for me. So if I'm employed full-time on a summer course, I go, well, that's my job. I'm not going to take on too much. So I'm not going to teach students on the side. I'm not going to mark essays on Saturdays. I'm not going to do extra training videos on a Sunday when I've got a full-time job. Okay, so that's me making decisions for myself. But not everyone makes those decisions because they feel that they've got to do this and they've got to do that. And some people have families and some people have children that they've got to look after and take care of as well. And I know somebody else is interviewing Rachel Roberts for this particular podcast. Yes. And she's a better person, I feel, she has written a lot about burnout. And she knows much more about, because she's into neuroscience and the way the brain works. Mm-hmm. My personal issues have been about panic attacks, panic disorder, anxiety. Mm-hmm. I've had depression as well, but in more recent years, it's been anxiety and panic. That's about perceptions and how I perceive mm-hmm. a non-existent threat, basically. Mm-hmm. So I can't speak with authority on burnout, but someone like Rachel Roberts can. Okay. And that's one of her specialisms, I would say.
And I think you've made a very useful point that everyone's experience is very personal. And it's also hard for even the specialist to generalize, let's face it. However, I can say from personal experience, my moments have been from panic, but also burnout. And there's been a combination of those two things. There's been a background of stressful environmental factors, world factors in fact as well, a certain element of burnout and panic arising from that, and through lack of sleep actually as an underlying cause. And the last time it happened to me was IOTF or Brighton, where I put myself on the spot, spoke in front of 200 people, which I hadn't done in a long time, I'm not used to doing, stressed myself out about being perfect with that workshop, and experienced a panic attack. Actually, the talk went absolutely fine, not as well as I would have liked as a perfectionist, but it went fine. But ultimately, my coping strategy was to leave and go and sit on the beach. And it was a very useful strategy at the time. So I think if all else fails for me, my personal experience is have a break.
And indeed, in Brighton at the same conference, I went for a walk on the beach with a storytelling friend, and we had an ice cream and we took time out from the conference because conferences themselves can be overwhelming for a lot of people.
Completely.
And I know people like Laura Patsko have written about conferences for introverts, because not everyone is an extrovert and can go around and socialize and present and go to all the events at something like an IOTF conference. I often privately think, and this is the first time I've publicly said this, which was my favorite IOTF conference. And I've had some terrible ones where I was full of anxiety and I couldn't leave my hotel room, like Liverpool 2013. But I've also had some fantastic ones. I think Brighton was my favorite one because I rode the crest of the wave. I know Brighton is by the seafront, but I actually rode the crest of the wave, figuratively and literally, I suppose. It was my first time I'd presented at conference. It was very well received. And I just had a fantastic experience. Right. But there's a little tiny thought in the back of the chimp-like brain that goes, this isn't going to last. You're going to fall on your face anytime soon. Mm-hmm. So there's always a little voice going...
The monkey mind.
The monkey mind telling you this won't last. You're going to fall down flat on your face before long. This is too good for you. It's too good to be true. And I got through that week at Brighton, and it was a fantastic week. That was my favourite conference, Brighton 2018.
Brighton 2018 was arguably my favourite conference too, for all sorts of different reasons, but I'm not sure I was riding a crest of a wave, a different kind of wave, but that's another time, another story.
I'm just saying, if you're somebody that's prone to anxiety like me, when things are going well, there is a a nice healthy level of anxiety going on. It's not like anxiety disappears completely. And anyone that knows anxiety, and you, I'm sure you can relate to this, can go, ah, this is a manageable level. And we wouldn't be human if we didn't feel some kind of fear or some kind of nervousness about something, because we want something to go well, maybe. So we wouldn't be human if we didn't feel anything at all. So
that's a process for us all, and there's plenty of resources out there. Are there any resources you would recommend, including perhaps resources that you produced?
Well, I'd like to mention a post that I wrote recently, which was about COVID-19 and mental health and well-being.
I've seen it.
That was very well received. And I was desperate to get it out there, because once this started happening, we'd heard it had happened in other European countries. And once it bit by bit came towards the United Kingdom, we started to get anxious ourselves as to how it was going to affect us and what kind of measures the government was going to take in place to tackle this. But I was immediately struck by the idea, if people have got to stay in their own homes for long periods of time in a lockdown scenario, that is going to have a negative impact on mental health and well-being. Whether you've got an existing condition or not, it's going to cause an absolutely sane person possibly to go stir crazy if they can't leave their house. And we are almost there. We are sort of 90-95% towards lockdown. We're still allowed to go out once a day for exercise or to go to the shops, but we can't get close to people. This has an impact, whether you're a teacher or not a teacher, this has an impact on everybody. And this is the first thing that has affected everyone and everything. We've never known anything like it. And it suddenly caused lots of schools, in order to survive, language schools, in order to carry on with provision, educational authorities like mine have had to adapt to online teaching very, very quickly and very, very suddenly. And we've had a lot of...
Stressful in itself, right?
Well, a lot of people, so-called experts, claiming that they know all about online teaching and to do this and to do that. And it's not true, because to put a proper online course into place, especially if it's for a large amount of learners and over a long period of time, you can't do that overnight. You can't even do it in 2 or 3 weeks. That takes months of planning. So...
Can you tell my employers that?
well, this is the current problem. We have employers wanting to carry on, wanting to provide education across the whole industry of ELT now, whether it's adult education like myself or language schools, and they are having to suddenly adapt. And some are in a good position to do that because they've already got things in place, and others are hopelessly out of touch with doing this. And this is causing stress in staff. I draw people's attention to my own website and my recent blog post about COVID-19 and mental health and well-being. I'd also draw people to Rachel Roberts's Life Resourceful website and her Facebook group. I know she's going to be part of this podcast as well. And I think she does a huge amount of work. She draws upon both her experience, a long experience as a materials writer and language teacher, and also her neuroscience psychology background as well. So she's really got an insight into how people like us, teachers, people in this profession, how we function. And also, not only my blog post, but her blog, you know, they talk about what this current situation, this unprecedented situation that we're in at the moment, how to cope with that.
One thing I've been discussing with some friends of mine recently, Phil, and that is people who have experienced mental health issues, crises, questions, however you want to talk about it, in the past, have perhaps the skill set to deal with this new layer of stress, the new demands put on us by the coronavirus. We have the toolbox, if you like, already to some extent, depending on our experience. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, actually, Christian, because I know from my experience that I've dealt with anxieties, I've dealt with stresses, and I've been worst when I perceive other people not to be suffering. Now that I know that other people are really struggling and really suffering, It's a weird feeling, but because I've had problems in the past, I'm coping with my own anxieties. I'm managing my own anxieties. And I'm actually dealing with this crisis better than most, because I'm used to, first, I'm used to my own company or doing a lot of stuff at my computer in my home. So that hasn't come as a shock to me. I'm also very au fait with technology and online teaching. So I'm not like a teacher who is suddenly having to go online and suddenly do all their teaching online and all the pressures and all the planning that comes involved with that. But I think that we do have a toolbox. Anyone who has had problems and has got through those, like I was saying at the beginning of the interview, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. I've come out the other side and learnt from that and learnt how to manage my condition And it does give me resources. I can draw upon my own strength, inner strength, to deal with something like this. And in terms of just day to day, I have a much better structure than I usually do when I'm at home. I make sure I go out for my 1 hour a day that we were currently allowed. And I don't constantly watch the news. Because if you constantly watch the news and you're constantly on social media, the general feeling at this time is you're going to be bombarded with negative stuff and there should be more positive stuff. So I've joined a very good Staying Positive Facebook group, Rachel's group, which I've already mentioned, very supportive, which is not there for telling you about the latest casualties, but it's there to support you and get you through this time. So yeah, I think it's a good point. Very good point.
Yeah, personally, I have been watching the news and also engaging quite a lot in social media, but I'm very careful what kind of social media as well and what groups I tap into, because there can be a lot of negativity and lots of fear, and I understand that. But it's also about managing my own structured life and setting a slightly different structure in place, having regularity with that, and yet just being at the moment as well and allowing myself not to feel like I always need to achieve just because we have this opportunity, so to speak. And yeah, just enjoying the sun, enjoying the sun. What an amazing opportunity we have right now to do all sorts of things and just to be.
Yeah, and just to finish what I said about gratitude earlier, I am grateful today that I was able to get out for an hour in the sunshine, albeit by myself. I managed to go to a park that wasn't overcrowded, and I felt that I've been somewhere today. But the first person to comment on Facebook was somebody who's in lockdown in Spain, and that's great that you're doing. You're setting a good example, Phil, but we can't go out. And it's like, okay, yeah. So I feel grateful for the fact, and I acknowledge the fact that we're still currently allowed to do that.
in the UK, but you also have international listeners, of course.
Of course, yeah, yeah. This is a pandemic that is affecting everyone and everything, really, isn't it?
Yeah, so, for sure.
But if people go to my website blog post, then they will see links to Mind, to Mental Health First Aid England, and even the BBC. And there's a lot of good resources out there. There's a lot of misinformation too, but you know, go to where the good resources are.
Thank you so much, Phil. We'll provide those resources, of course, alongside this podcast. Take care, be safe, and let's remind ourselves to not take on too much and to breathe, right?
Indeed, we must remember to keep on breathing. The trick is to keep breathing.
Keep breathing, yeah, that's the most important thing, overriding everything.
But not too closely in company of strangers. All right. Thank you anyway.
Thank you so much, Phil. It's been a real pleasure listening to you. Really interesting and an insight.
It's a pleasure to talk about this topic.
Take care. I'm going to enjoy the sun. I don't know about you.
I'm going to have another half an hour.
Okay. Take care. Take care. Thanks a million.
Hi, everybody. This is Tyson Seaburn, the coordinator of TDSIG. How are you all? This is the first time since the whole COVID-19 deferred our PCE to next year that I've had the chance to update you on anything. I hope you're all doing okay, and if you've been overwhelmed with the transition to online everything, you're not alone. Believe me, the TDSIG community are feeling it alongside you. In fact, we participated in a panel discussion last month at the IATEFL Global Get-Together to talk as experts with other SIG leaders about this transition. You can watch this in your IATEFL members area. In some other news, we have a new community member, Irene Varela. She's a DOS in a local private school in Montevideo, Uruguay, and she's really interested in flipped learning and PBL. She is working as part of our social media voice, so you're gonna hear from her on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. So if you haven't followed us, you should go to one of those or all of them and follow us there. She is leading a new series on Monday called Monday Reading Series, and that's where we're posting an article. It's kind of like a article book club. If you want to read it, just go to our Facebook or our Twitter, and you can reply and comment. Right now, not a lot of people are commenting, but we'd really like to have more people participating and sharing their ideas about these weekly discussions. On Tuesdays, I don't know if you've seen it or not yet, but we're leading a hashtag chat discussion called SIG Tweet Meet. That's at 10 a.m. Toronto time, 11 a.m. Brasilia, 3 p.m. London, 4 p.m. Paris, 6:30 p.m. Tehran and 10 p.m. Taipei. So at one of those times, which is the same time for everybody, actually, you can log on to Twitter, follow the hashtag SigTweetMeet, and we basically just have a casual chat. Usually it's around a theme. One week we did fun, another week we did shifting routines, and next week we're going to be talking about preparing to teach EAP online. But it's more like a break time chat, so you don't really have to prepare. Finally, in publication news, by this time next month, so in June, we'll have three publications to look forward to. One is a follow-up Q&A to the panel discussion I mentioned earlier that will be on our blog. Second is we are relaunching our members' e-bulletin as a sort of more concise, kind of directly relevant, really impactful thematic emailed publication called TD Link Up. And long time coming, but the first volume of our academic journal, TDAJ, with 7 articles related to teacher development, will be open access on our website at this time in June. So, on that note, I sign off for now. So, take care, everyone, and, be cautious in these times. We'll all get this through this together. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Developpod, and a big thank you to Phil for giving us his time. He mentioned Rachel Roberts several times in the interview, and I'm delighted to say that she'll be joining us in part 2 of this special series on mental health and well-being. So look out for that coming soon. As always, the best way to stay in touch with us is via social media. Just look for TDSIG on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, and make sure to subscribe to this show on your podcast player, whether that's Spotify or Apple Music or another. And if you could leave us a review or rating on that app, we'd really appreciate it. Until the next episode, this is James Taylor saying thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of Developpod.